So today's Dhamma talk is in two pretty distinct parts. In the first part, I want to talk a little bit more about this category you've been dwelling in the last 24 hours, the enemy, as it's called in the Visuddhimagga. And then in the second part, I want to talk a little bit more about jhana, because I've received some questions about it, so to clarify, amplify, put in context. So, the enemy. This category is really, of all of the categories of individual people in the process of the metta practice, this category is the one that can provide the most powerful purification. And I have to say, I personally like it best. Not because I'm a masochist, because I'm not, but because I have a very strong tendency for dosa. So this particular category for me has been the one that has really convinced me of the transformative nature of this metta practice. I was a skeptic before, but this category is what did it for me. So, as I said, in the Visuddhimagga, the category is called the enemy, which is, in English, extremely dramatic language. In the West, the terminology that is used in English anyway is often the difficult person, which is actually a bit of a euphemism. It's not a problem to admit that we actually occasionally do dislike people. So to call it what it is, the disliked person. But of course, there are many shades of this category. A number of people have said they've been waiting for this category the whole retreat. This is what they came to work with. Maybe there was, you know, in some cases it was one person, or in some cases it's just a general tendency that people want to come to grips with. And we've only had 24 hours. It's a longer process, of course. Even though we've been cultivating loving kindness here for almost 2 weeks, it's a relatively short time, especially if we want to really engage in this particular category of being and our own responses to this category and the people in it. So we need a lot of momentum of loving kindness, which is one of the reasons Sayadaw let you sit for days and days on the dear friend, because this is a category that can bring a lot of momentum for people. So it's a way of kind of revving things up, getting a running head start in order to make the leap eventually to this difficult category. It can really take more than a couple of weeks. It can take, in some cases, a lifetime. And, you know, everywhere in between. Everybody's got their own schedule. But it takes the time it takes. And as with any of the other categories, as with the metta practice in general, we begin where it's easiest. And in this category, of course, as you know, easiest can be just a mildly irritating person. Someone here on retreat whom you don't know, so there's no personal hook, but maybe they breathe too loudly, or maybe they chew too loudly, or maybe there's something about them that just bothers you. Maybe it's their socks. It can be anything on retreat. So we start with this easiest person and begin to tiptoe into deeper water. And it's like, you know, when you go swimming in the ocean and it's cold. Some people dive right in, but a lot of people, they get a foot wet and then another one, and then once they're used to the temperature, they get in little by little. And once you get in, it's comfortable. But the getting in is a slow process. The easiest people here are people like these mildly irritating people. People who are in our, what I call our dosa outbox. People that we direct the dosa towards. People we have negative reactions to, whether mild irritation or outright hatred. So we begin with the mildest, and a number of you have discovered that as you radiate loving kindness to these very mildly irritating people, the metta just, the irritation vanishes, it's gone. Pretty easily in some cases. So then we can go to something or someone for whom there's a bigger reaction, a larger amount of dosa in the outbox, a genuine cause of sustained grievance, perhaps a neighbor. Neighbors are often dosa generating people because we're all different and we all have to live in kind of close quarters. And so they have different taste in music. They have different volumes at which they live their lives. They have different relationships to trees or gardens or lawn mowing or junk cars, or you name it. I mean, it can be anything, almost anything. And these people that we meet, perhaps even every day, it can also be somebody at work. These can be very kind of prickly relationships. You know, we meet these people every day, and the relationship can feel toxic. So this is a category of person that we can take some time to step up to. So don't start where the relationship is extremely toxic. That's too much. Start with a slightly less difficult person. And just continue to radiate the loving kindness. And remember, in this category in particular, it's really important to remember to all as to myself. To all as to myself applies to the difficult person particularly. Remembering they are also people. They're not robots. They're not from outer space. They're not another species. They're human beings just like us, with different priorities, different opinions, different ways of doing things, whatever it is. And connecting at that human level is very, very helpful. Pardon me. This is a place where the water gets gradually deeper. There can be a parade, just like with the dear friend. We can practice with many of these people with whom we have grievances. And then we get to another place where the metta requires a step deeper. And this is a person we actually deeply resent or hate. Not everybody has somebody like this in their life. It doesn't have to be somebody you know. For many people in the world now, there are politicians that engender this response. And a lot of hatred can be generated by somebody whose public actions frighten us or concern us. And one thing to be interested in, as far as this category is concerned, is to look carefully. Many people say, oh, I don't hate anybody. Maybe. Maybe that's true. I mean, for some people it is true. They genuinely do not hate other people. However, as I said, there's no harm in admitting to yourself that this mind state of hatred has arisen. Not admitting it is actual resistance. But of course, we don't want to feed that by, you know, just following that hatred. And we do tend to suppress these feelings of hatred. Especially women. We're not supposed to feel this as women. Men are luckier in this regard because men have more propension in our culture to be angry. But women, no, you're not allowed to hate anybody. You're supposed to be nice. And, you know, ooh. There can be quite a lot of response happening under all of that. So somebody we hate, or if we know them, perhaps they, you know, we deeply resent something about them. So these are all people that get filed in our dosa out box. People that we are, you know, directing dosa towards very strongly. Not because of anything necessarily that they've done, just because of our own habits and conditioning. And yeah, maybe they have done something, but it's usually coming from us. And then there are people I tend to think of, oh, people who are filling up my dosa inbox. I don't have many people like this in my life. I'm very fortunate. But these are people who have hurt or harmed us in some way or another. The dosa is directed to us. The harm has been directed to us first. And then we have a dosa reaction. Either fear, resentment, hatred, dismissing, just not even wanting to think about them anymore, wishing they weren't on the planet. You know, some kind of response that is the direct result of hurt or harm. And this is the classical enemy. And this is actually a very difficult category. Because when we've been hurt or harmed, we tend to go to fight or flight. These two physiologically hardwired responses. Fight, of course, is outright dosa. Flight is the dosa that looks like fear. Trauma, anxiety. And there can be a lot of overlap between the person I was just talking about, the person we hate or resent, and this category of person who actually has harmed us. Because that hatred and resentment may be the direct result of hurt or harm. So we have this kind of range of beings for whom we can radiate loving kindness that fall into this category of the enemy / the difficult person / the disliked person. And because it's such a rich category, and because it takes some time to develop a true and very genuine loving kindness, this can be the practice of a lifetime, not just for one retreat, but for long periods of time. And one person was saying to me, and I think she was being, her point is extremely important. She was saying how important it is to actually have genuine metta for these people, as opposed to the kind of facade that you see some people wearing, where we love our brothers as ourselves, but, you know, really we don't. And so this practice takes us to that place of genuine, heartfelt connection, of genuine appreciation of common humanity, of genuine care, even tenderness. And this is a very interesting place to land when you've been doing this category for a while, when the heart breaks into tenderness for a difficult person. And especially when that person has been a subject of quite a lot of difficulty. And we can learn a lot along the way as we deal with this category over and over and over again. The first is we see really vividly in our own experience how resistance in one person, in the form of, you know, dosa or ill will, can jump to another person and create the same thing, and how that can be a poisonous, toxic feedback loop. How when resistance meets resistance, it just amplifies both. So, of course, doing this metta practice, the whole point is to stop that feedback loop in its tracks and do the opposite. So just as in the Buddha's teaching there is dependent origination, how we keep creating suffering, there is transcendent dependent origination, how we can feed a feedback loop that frees us from suffering. And how resentment amplifies is one version of this dependent origination. Based on resentment, more resentment arises. Based on that, even more, and it, you know, so on. More division, more hatred. But with the metta, based on metta, resentment dissolves, and there's less and less and more metta. So we have a choice, and we know we have a choice. There might be some resistance to that choice. Please don't worry. Please don't worry if the mind wants to dwell in dosa. Don't make it a big deal. Just notice that resentment and keep radiating the loving kindness. These dosa-based reactions can feed so much identification, so much ego, that they're really sticky. They have a very strong, what I think of as a gravitational field. And we can bond This is where it gets very interesting, because especially in a workplace situation or a family kind of group dynamic, when there's tension, we can bond with other people over our mutual dosa responses, can't we? And this is not a nice thing to kind of really let in, but it's true, it happens. And most of us have done it. There might be somebody at work we're struggling with, and we find a coworker who agrees with us, and so we kind of collect in a corner together with this person and go, yeah. And we work ourselves up into a mutual dosa fit. And, you know, yeah, that's how workplace toxins spread and how really poisonous workplaces get created. Because, you know, lots of people do this. Maybe about us. We're doing it about them. They're doing it about us. You don't know who to trust. So, really, taking this practice to heart, knowing that deeply you actually do want to cultivate the metta more deeply than you do the dosa, that there's this habitual, transient, temporary condition of feeling pulled to that kind of juicy thought about that person who is so wrong, and how wronged you were, or whatever it is. And just keep putting it aside, keep cultivating the loving kindness, the phrase, the person, patiently wearing away that habit. So we see these, sometimes all too vividly, these patterns of resentment and mutual amplification. But we also see the flip side of that. We see the power of metta as a healing force, internally and externally. We see both internally and externally how when friendliness meets resistance, often the resistance crumbles. It's like calling out, you know, a schoolyard bully and realizing they're actually quite frightened and they back off. So with neighbors, this can be a very interesting process, because often neighborly disputes are over things where people have different opinions or different agendas. And so if the neighbor comes over in a huff and says, and, you know, we respond in kind, this is the kind of tension that can escalate. But if we meet that with, oh, let's talk. I understand. You know, you need this. I need this, and they're slightly different, so how can we work it out? Often there's surprise, because people tend to deal with potential conflicts by, you know, coming on a little strong in order to meet expected resistance. And when they don't meet that, then I had a wonderful experience of this when I moved from Hawaii to New Zealand, very long time ago now. And we'd bought a house in a town where the section, a part of the town where the sections were quite steep. And so the house was built on this very steep hill and a long, narrow section. So we had a section in the back. And at the back of the property, there was a tall hedge. And one of the things that was most valued in this particular neighborhood was the view of the lake and the mountains. So, of course, everybody wanted a view, their own view of the lake and the mountains. And the people from whom we'd bought the house warned us, "Oh, Mr. Davis, the back neighbor, you're going to have trouble with him. He took us to court over the hedge." I thought, oh, goody. And so very soon after we moved in, I was up making myself a vegetable garden up there in the back of the property, and I hear a rustle, and it's Mr. Davis from next door, and it's a very gruff voice. He's like, "Hello." And I'm like, "Oh, hello, you must be Mr. Davis. I've heard about you." Smiling. He introduced himself. "Yes, I'm Mr. Davis. I've lived here for so many years. And, you know, the people who had the house before, we had trouble with this hedge, you know." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I heard about that." And I said, "Please, don't worry. I totally understand your need for a view. I like the view, too. That's why we bought the house." You could see his face changing. It's like, oh. Suddenly, he didn't have to kind of defend himself. And so I assured him, and this always happened, that we would keep the hedge trimmed to the level that the council had said, the arbitrator had said they had to keep the hedge down to this certain level. I said, "Oh, I know all about that, and we'll be really, you know, we understand you want the view, and very easy for us to do that." He went away happy. I went away relieved. And we actually had a very cordial relationship over that back hedge. He was always Mr. Davis. It wasn't, you know, a lovey-dovey, wonderful friendship. But we exchanged lemons or whatever, you know, over the back hedge, and all was well. There's a choice in situations like this. You know, it's how do you meet other people? How do you meet yourself? So metta, when we use it skillfully in this category, can be a powerful healing force in ourselves and in our communities. Not only as a source of communal peace and ease, we also see how in the practice itself, how instantaneously metta can dissolve mild irritation. You know, it feels sometimes like fog on a sunny morning. Poof, it just vanishes. And it really shows us how that irritation, which can feel so solid, is actually quite ephemeral. And how the metta can just push it out of the way. And also we see how metta can instantaneously deal with even more powerful forms of dosa. And this can be actually quite surprising or even shocking if it's never happened to us before. Rage, resentment that we've held for years. When we continue to cultivate metta in the face of these emotions, they can vanish from one moment to the next and be replaced by really powerful metta. And don't take my word for it. See for yourself. And many of you have had this happen. So this is something that when it happens to you for the first time, it's so incredibly surprising. It's like, wow, what just happened? There was that rage, and now it's just gone. Especially because we think of these emotions as having, you know, real staying power. We think of these emotions as something that, you know, last. But they're just as ephemeral as the irritation. They're stronger. They're more powerful. We're more identified with them. But they have that same nature of being like a soap bubble. Poof, the metta can pop them. Or it can feel like, you know, glass shattering, boom, gone. It's very satisfying when this happens. And usually it's not easy. And one thing to consider in the context of this retreat, or any retreat, especially for those of you who are not so familiar with the process of what happens when we sit together here in silence, is how in this silent retreat container, strong anger about seemingly trivial things can arise, out of proportion to the triggers, and way more than we'd normally respond. These dosa states feel like they're amped up, amplified. And there can be a number of reasons for this. Sometimes it's because we're acknowledging, unearthing things we've suppressed or not acknowledged. If you've spent your lifetime suppressing anger, it can arise when it's suddenly acknowledged. It can arise in almost a volcanic way. And the other thing that is happening, which is pretty universal, and it's got a name, actually. And because of the silence, because of the concentration, because of just the form, the intense form of the retreat, greed, hatred, delusion, all our reactivity is magnified. Concentration, in particular, magnifies the kilesas, magnifies the distortions of the mind. We call this yogi mind. And from the outside looking in, it's rather amusing. But when we're stuck in it, it can be really a hell realm. And it helps to know this dynamic because it can seem so intense in the middle of a retreat over what is normally nothing. On my very first retreat, I spun out, I mean, with absolute rage, literally rage. It was crazy. But over the fact that somebody who I knew, she was actually a friend with whom I'd come to the retreat, she gave me a ride to the retreat, she did something at breakfast on the first morning that bothered me, that I thought was self-centered and, you know, getting in the way of everybody. It was really nothing, but I went into a total rage about this. So much so that when we were doing walking meditation after breakfast, and in that retreat we were doing walking meditation in the Zendo, this was a Vipassana retreat, but we were doing walking meditation not back and forth, but in a circle all together in this small room. So every time her socks passed me, I literally wanted to hit her. I wanted to, you know, just, you're such, yeah. And, you know, of course I didn't. I kept practicing. But I also thought I was going a little crazy. This was nuts. What is going on here? I mean, yeah, she does this all the time, so what's the big deal? It wasn't even anything I didn't know about. This is how yogi mind can work. And often in retreat centers in the West, in particular, where people write notes to the office, sometimes long-term people, you know, who work in retreat center offices have a little place on their bulletin board for the funnier notes, yogi mind notes. And they're always signed with metta. And it can be so, you wonder what planet that person is on. Somebody at the Insight Meditation Center famously wrote a note to the office requesting that they call the air traffic control people in Boston for, you know, over the last 3 days they've been routing the planes over the retreat center and it's disturbing my concentration with metta. And this person wasn't joking. Yeah, right, okay. We take things so seriously when we're stuck in yogi mind. And we take them so personally. This is how window wars start, and wars in the dining room over how fast you go in the meal queue. And people, you see them amping it up by either going faster behind somebody or slower in front of somebody, or both at the same time. Yeah. So understanding that this can happen is very, very helpful. It brings a little lightness. It's like, oh, this is yogi mind. So before you go to somebody and says, really, you know, you have to deal with this person who's doing this, first deal with the dosa. This is the place for the metta practice. May we be at ease in this situation is a good place to start. Or may I be at ease in this situation? Just going back to yourself, gently, persistently, with humor and understanding. Oh, this is just dosa. This is just yogi mind. Yes, I believe it right now, but later, may I be at ease. May I be at ease. But, may I be at ease. But, you know, we're so right often in these situations. So if this is you and you've been having something like this happen, please don't worry. Don't also worry that it might follow you home. It probably won't. And know that the metta practice is there explicitly for this. And if we collected a story from everybody here, it would probably make a very funny book. You know, we all experience this. And with patient persistence, the metta and the concentration really do erode the power of that. And with this category as a whole, one thing to consider if you're struggling with it, and if you're struggling particularly with resentment, which is a form of dosa that is really very poisonous, is to know that in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha recommended metta as the first tactic, the go-to tactic for dissolving resentment. And then if that didn't work, doesn't work, then the next is compassion. And somebody mentioned this to me today, how working with a difficult person wasn't really, there wasn't much traction until out came the compassion and the heart softened. And that's actually a very powerful way to undermine powerful states of hatred and anger and resentment. So if the metta practice doesn't work, the Buddha recommends karuna practice, cultivating the karuna in the same way. And karuna is actually no different than metta. It's simply metta that inclines towards the unhappiness or suffering of another person. So you can shift the phrase a little bit. May you be free from your suffering, or whatever feels like it resonates. And then if that doesn't work, then what the Buddha recommends is two aspects of upekkha, equanimity. The first being the specific cultivation of equanimity in the same way as we cultivate metta by using the phrase over and over again, as Ariya mentioned the other day. As well as the more reflective contemplation of the simple word kamasaka, which is the Pali word which means ownership of action. All beings are heirs to their kamma, basically, cause and effect. What seeds we planted, if they grow and fruit, that's the fruit we eat, kamasaka. And it cuts both ways, both for us and for a difficult person. And this, I found, can really help both the metta and karuna practice as a support when working with a really difficult, hated person who might be acting extremely unskillfully. This opens the heart to compassion. It's like when you think of what some people are doing in the world, the consequences of that, the fruit, the karmic fruit they will reap, oh, there will be a lot of suffering at some point in the future. So that opens the door to a natural flow of metta. So even if you feel like there's one-pointed concentration on the negative aspects of someone, you know, you feel like you can't pry the mind away from that, remembering that with time and patient persistence, the metta will eventually bring the concentration to that metta place. You just have to keep going with this category. So those of you who are leaving in a few days, feel free to play with this at home. Those of you who are staying for another 2 weeks, feel free to keep going with this category. It can be very, very rich. So that's just a few words of encouragement, almost an hour's worth, about this very challenging but very rich and fruitful category. And I want to say just a few words now about concentration, about jhana, in answer to a few questions that people have asked. And to add some context to what Saito spoke about yesterday when he spoke about the metta jhanas. Because the question that I've received more than once, actually, in different guises, are, so why so much about the jhanas? What's wrong with just cultivating metta? Isn't the metta more important than just the simple concentration? And the answer to that is, well, it depends. Both are important. And it depends on your intention. For some people, the priority is the metta. And for other people, the jhana is the main thing they're interested in cultivating. And for some people, it's both. These states, strong and powerful metta, the metta jhanas, both of these are wholesome. So one is not necessarily better than the other. So depending on your situation in life, for someone living a very full and engaged life as a layperson, totally engaged in alleviating the suffering of the world, the metta is going to be the main priority, probably. For someone who's living a more contemplative life, totally devoted to freeing the heart from greed, hatred, and delusion with meditation and practice, it's probably going to be the jhana. And for most of us, even as monastics, the truth falls somewhere in between those two. And at different times in the practice and at different times in the life, sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other. At sometimes, all we want to do is intensive practice. And then it can be extremely helpful to have some facility in working with the jhanas. At other times in the life, we're more interested in polishing our what's called the paramis, the perfections, these wholesome qualities of mind that support a happy and harmonious existence, metta being one of them. So if the jhanas are not your thing, it's okay. If the metta is the main thing, it's okay. If you're really, really interested in the jhanas, and well, the metta, yeah, that's nice. That's okay too. It's easy and common for people to take a stance one way or the other, but I just really want to caution you about that. Because you can hear people say, you know, extreme things in the Dharma world. Oh, you can't succeed in the practice without really delving into the jhanas. You know, people who don't do the jhanas are wasting their time. Or the other extreme, it's like, oh, God, you know, why are these people doing this? They have to live in the world. These are kind of gross caricatures. But never mind what people say. Trust your own heartfelt, wholesome intention, one way or the other. And if people say things and have strong opinions, well, just remember strong opinions are fixed views, often coming from ego and nothing to do with you. You know, just let it go by. Goodness is goodness. Some people prefer apples to oranges, and a fight about which one is better is just silly. So the whole practice leads to a place of fluidity, of non-attachment, even to the practice and the forms the practice takes. So there's no right or wrong way to do a wholesome practice. There's so many different minds and hearts, and so many different ways of practice that are necessary for those individual minds and hearts. So when people judge us based on their own process, well, or vice versa, we judge people based on our own process. They're not going slow enough. They're being bad yogis because they're going too slow. Whatever it is, this is just projection and fixed view. So really trust where you are in this, and trust where other people are in this. And if there's strong comparing mind, just, you know what to do with that. And the jhanas themselves do have a number of specific benefits. There's a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya which speaks, it's called the Samadhi Sutta. It's in the Book of Fives. And it gives a list of five benefits that accrue to somebody who's developed jhana based on one of the four boundless states, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. And basically they all boil down to a profound deepening of confidence, both in the practice and one's own ability to engage in it successfully, as well as to eventually an ability to access these profoundly quiet states at will. So the main benefit of jhana, one of the main benefits of jhana, is deepening the faith, deepening our confidence in ourself and in the practice. And of course, in addition to that, are the direct benefits of calm, quiet, one-pointedness. And the metta jhana in particular is a profound support for our vipassana practice. Sayadaw Uindaka has written a book about how to use the metta practice in support of vipassana. And basically, in a nutshell, what he is describing is a process whereby people attain a state of metta jhana, and then based on that jhana, they begin to practice vipassana meditation. They, quote-unquote, emerge from the jhana. They say, okay, now I'm going to practice vipassana. And then they take that very calm, quiet stillness, those jhana states, as the object, as vipassana objects, as the object of their vipassana meditation, and then continue in the vipassana practice. The metta jhana in particular are useful for the vipassana practice, not just because of the concentration, which is good in and of itself and beneficial in and of itself for vipassana, but because of the very presence of the metta. This is what makes it different. This metta, this friendly, interested, kind attitude that comes with metta, that pervades internally as well as externally. When it's strong, we no longer resist anything that's arising. So everything becomes much more malleable in the vipassana practice. Suddenly all those kilesas are not enemies to be destroyed without mercy, but they just become interesting objects. We're not in any way pushing them away. And this is a very, it seems like it might be a subtle shift, but it's a profound change in attitude in the practice. That's the other reason, besides how powerful metta is in dissolving dosa. That's the other reason I really treasure this metta practice, because it's transformed my vipassana practice, and I've seen how it transforms other people's vipassana practice. I could go on, but time is short. So the jhana has benefits. The metta has benefits. Please cultivate either or both of these. Of course, jhana is not essential for the metta to have great benefits. Personally, and collectively, metta in the world is an absolute need right now. So for those of you who are going out soon into this world, Ariya will offer more words about integration, how to take this practice and use it in life. But as Sayadaw often says to people when they leave, don't leave the metta here in the meditation hall. Take it with you, please. It's really the very best souvenir you could take home from this beautiful and very precious country. Excuse me, I find this very moving because there's nothing better in the world than this beautiful state of metta, and it's so strong here. And the cultivation of it is so important and so valued in Burma. You've all received a lot of metta from all the army of people in the kitchen, all the ladies in there, from Sayadaw, from the monks, from all the helpers. They do this because of metta. So please take it home with you. Remember metta indeed, speech and thought, and take it as your everyday practice out in the world. I want to close with a passage from the Anguttara Nikaya, which I like very, very much. The Buddha is addressing a group of monks, and you can consider yourself all as monks. He says, Bhikkhus, there are these five means of dwelling at ease. What five? Here a bhikkhu maintains bodily acts of loving kindness towards his fellow monks, both openly and privately. He maintains verbal acts of loving kindness towards his fellow monks, both openly and privately. He maintains mental acts of loving kindness towards his fellow monks, both openly and privately. He dwells openly and private, possessing in common with his fellow monks virtuous behavior that is unbroken, flawless, unblemished, praised by the wise, leading to concentration. He dwells both openly and privately, possessing in common with his fellow monks the view that is noble and emancipating, which leads one who acts upon it to the complete destruction of suffering. These bhikkhus are the five means of dwelling at ease. Metta in deed, in speech, in thought, openly and privately. So, we have our work cut out for us. And for those leaving, I really want to sincerely and heartfully thank you for your practice. And thank you for taking this out into the world. And for those staying, thank you for your practice. May we all live together with ease and harmony, dwelling both openly and privately, with metta in deed, in speech, and thought. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.